Welcome to International Portfolio, a new audio cassette journal on foreign affairs. I'm Frank Blair in New York. In the 2 hours that follow, we'll tackle some of the most awesome problems of our time. The nuclear arms race, our relations with China and Russia, and the global economic crisis. We'll also hear about how things look from the Third World, the prospects for democracy worldwide, and Anglo-American relations since the Falklands War. To begin, let's go now to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and hear Harvard specialist Michael Nacht ask about U.S. nuclear strategy.
The topic for discussion today is the nuclear arms race. Can it be contained and controlled? With me to discuss this topic is Joseph Nye, professor of government at Harvard University, who served during the Carter administration as Deputy Undersecretary of State, responsible for nuclear nonproliferation policy. Professor Nye, perhaps we could begin the discussion by exploring exactly where we are with respect to the nuclear weapons possessed by both the Soviet Union and the United States.
Well, a general description of the nuclear balance is a political judgment, and it's usually summed up by a term like rough equivalence or parity, rough parity, something of that sort. But to understand it, it's perhaps useful to think of a metaphor not of a single arms race, like a long-distance run, but of a track meet in which many events are going on at the same time. And how you score a track meet, whether the discus is equivalent to the javelin and whether the 100 meter is as important as the quarter mile, is often a difficult judgment. In the nuclear area, the United States is ahead in the number of warheads. The Soviet Union is ahead in the number of strategic delivery systems. The Soviet Union is ahead in the destructive power of all the bombs and warheads they have, but the United States is ahead in terms of the payload. That is how many bombs or warheads can be carried, their weight that can be carried on bombers and missiles. So you have four different measures, and the U.S. ahead on two, the Soviets ahead on two. Now, in recent years, there's been some particular concern about one part of that balance, which is those missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles, that are based on land. And in that area, the Soviets are ahead. They started out with large, crude missiles. They've gradually made them more accurate. And since the late 1970s, there's been a growing concern about the prospect that the Soviets could perhaps launch a first strike against our land-based missiles and essentially destroy more than 90% of them. There's a big dispute as to how significant that is. One camp or one view, which has been accepted by the Reagan administration, says that's very significant because a president might be faced with a choice after the Soviets had destroyed our land-based missiles of either using the submarines to retaliate against Soviet cities because the submarine missiles are not accurate enough to strike Soviet missiles, or of surrendering. The alternative view says, look, that isn't the choice. If the Soviets were to try to strike our land-based missiles, this would mean detonating 2,000 nuclear warheads all over the Midwest of the United States. And when an American president saw 2,000 warheads coming in, he might well launch our missiles before the Soviet missiles arrived. He might also decide, even after this explosion had occurred, to use the submarines not against Soviet silos, but against Soviet armies or airfields or other relatively soft targets and create equivalent damage. It's not necessarily a choice of all or nothing for the American reply. So it's more a question of political perception rather than of actual military significance.
Would you, on balance, feel that there is a stalemate here? Or do certain advantages make more of a difference than others?
Well, I think in this area it's worth doing a little test that's sometimes put to people, which is, would you be willing to trade forces with the Soviet Union? And the interesting thing that even President Reagan has answered that question, no. The Russians have a force that has about 3/4 of it in land-based missiles, much weaker in bombers and submarines. And the interesting thing about that is that the very fact that gives us great concern today, that these land-based missiles will become more vulnerable as accuracies improve on intercontinental missilery, is a problem that's going to be very great for the Russians in the 1980s. I think one has to be awfully careful not to negotiate a one-time measure.
Well, you've provided us with a snapshot of the current situation, but it is often useful to figure out how we got here. How did we accumulate so many weapons over these years, and for what purposes?
Well, if you go back to the origins, when the U.S. had a nuclear weapon in 45 and the Russians followed suit in 49, you have to see the intense political rivalry which was left at the end of World War II. Most other countries had been prostrate as the end of the war. The United States and the Soviets were the two major powers which still existed. The Americans had nuclear weaponry, but not very strong conventional forces because we demobilized. The Soviets had very strong conventional forces, but not yet nuclear weapons. The Americans then used nuclear weaponry to balance the Soviet conventional advantage. And during the course of the 1950s, as the Americans developed greater levels of weaponry in terms of the bomber forces that were then used, the Soviets lagged behind. But the Soviets essentially tried to cover up the lag and indeed often encouraged us to think that they were stronger than they were because they wanted political advantage from that in terms of the competition with the United States. So then in the 1950s, you had our concern about a bomber gap, that the Soviets were suddenly going to have a huge number of bombers that would threaten us. Turned out later to be false, but part of it was because the Soviets took the same bombers and kept flying them by in their military parades to encourage us to believe they were stronger than they were. The missile gap turned out to be the same sort of thing in the late 1950s. The answer to that is that in a condition of intense political rivalry and competition, when you have one society which is very open and transparent, and the other society is like a black box, it's almost impossible to find out what the Soviets are really up to because of their secrecy, there's a great opportunity to make worst-case assumptions and misjudgments, which then drive new programs. The net effect of that has been a rather jerky process, very imperfect, in which there has been this tremendous buildup over time.
One point I wanted to follow up on, you said that one of the original purposes of the American acquisition of nuclear weapons was to compensate for inferiority in conventional forces. Well, it appears that the Soviet Union continues to enjoy superiority in terms of numbers of tanks deployed and numbers of aircraft and so forth. So wouldn't that suggest that the United States really needs to maintain a position of nuclear superiority to compensate for the conventional inferiority, or has somehow that logic been overtaken by events?
Well, the prospect of obtaining nuclear superiority is almost nil, because one of the things that happened over the past 15 or 20 years since the Cuban Missile Crisis was a consistent Soviet buildup of about 4% a year increases in their defense budget and in their strategic forces, which meant that by about 1970, they'd caught up with strategic parity with the United States. I don't see the Soviets allowing us to forge out ahead in nuclear weaponry. If one looks at the overall situation of the Soviet Union, you have to realize that they have a Chinese problem, and a good quarter of their forces are deployed against the Chinese. They also have the problem of occupation troops in effect in Eastern Europe and a certain degree of unreliability of some of their Warsaw Pact allies. And some of the crude ratios of Soviet conventional superiority become a little less frightening if you realize that we have Canada and Mexico to worry about on basically undefended borders, and they have countries like Germany and China, and south of them Afghanistan, Pakistan, and so forth. In Europe, in particular, one has to realize that the answer to tanks may not be only other tanks, but also anti-tank weaponry. And the development of new generations of very precise weaponry in terms of defeating tanks may be as important as the ratio of tanks per se. So the degree of conventional imbalance that exists is probably not so great as to tempt the Soviets now into an attack.
Probably much of what we've been talking about up to now would be of relatively limited interest to large numbers of people if it wasn't for the very concrete fear that these weapons would be used, and that we would not just be talking about an arms race, but in fact a nuclear holocaust beyond any catastrophe that the world has ever seen. We saw witnessed in 1982 alone 1 million people demonstrating in New York City against the continued accumulation of these weapons. I believe the largest demonstration in post-war Germany occurred in 1982, and there were many other public outcries about this seemingly irrational accumulation of nuclear weapons by both the superpowers. As an expert in the field, what is your assessment of the probability of nuclear war and of these weapons actually being used, let's say, in this decade and perhaps by the end of this century?
Well, if you ask how a nuclear war might begin, there are a variety of ways. Sometimes people worry about a sudden Russian strike a la Pearl Harbor. Other people worry about an accident, a computer chip going wrong. Other people worry about nuclear wars that would start between, let's say, India and Pakistan and then spread to the superpowers. Those first three prospects all strike me as pretty low. The one that worries me most is the prospect that some event would occur in an area of great importance to us, like Europe or the Persian Gulf, and through a process of miscalculations could lead from one step to another. In other words, you'd have escalation from an originally conventional conflict into some sort of nuclear war. I think the chances of that are very low because I think essentially the leaders of both the United States and the Soviet Union realize how extraordinarily damaging a nuclear war would be. So I think that I would rate the chances of nuclear war something like 1 in 1,000 between the U.S. and the Soviet in the next 10 years. I think that's much too high, and that number scares me. But I'm intrigued that the public rates it much more like 1 in 2. Most of the experts come out around 1 in 100 or a little lower.
Does that tell us that the experts know something that the public doesn't know, or is it the reverse?
No, the experts aren't necessarily right, but experts do know things about permissive action links, which basically are electronic combination locks, so that if somebody steals a weapon, they can't make it go off. They also know something about these various events that have been reported in the press about faulty computer chips and realize that there were many, many more steps that had to be taken and various protections built in before that would have led to any kind of a presidential decision. What the experts don't know, and neither does anybody else, is how to deal with Murphy's Law. Murphy's Law is that whatever can go wrong will go wrong. And the other thing the experts don't know much about is irrationality. All this works as long as people are rational, but suppose somebody goes crazy at the top. I think the public views may be a bit too high. I think the experts may a bit be too sanguine because of their failure to spend enough time thinking about irrationality.
The assumption, I think, is fairly clear that if the United States and the Soviet Union in particular limit and reduce the number of nuclear weapons that they have, the probability of their use will decline. What is your judgment about the prospects of serious arms control agreements between the United States and the Soviet Union in this decade? Can intense political rivals reach serious arms control agreements?
Well, my answer to that is yes, but we have to be awfully careful with the assumption that just reducing the numbers per se reduces the probability of their use. Don't misunderstand me, I'm for reducing the number of weapons as well, but if I had to make a choice between type and number, I'd focus first on type and then second on number. That means that in arms control negotiations, it's a question of whether you can limit certain types that are particularly destabilizing. The other thing that's worth noticing is that there are a number of procedures which are related to arms control. For example, the hotline, improving communications at a time of crisis, or the SALT treaty, the agreement not to try to blind or hide things from each other's surveillance satellites. These things may be as important as the actual question of numbers.
You've certainly illuminated some of the trade-offs and some of the complexities inherent in this whole business. There seems to be now quite a political groundswell in the United States which says all of these complexities really do not need to be addressed in the first place. Why don't we just stop? Why don't we just freeze everything exactly where it is now as the first step?
I think you can try to freeze some things. I indeed would support a partial freeze. But I don't think you can freeze everything. For example, if you stop submarines but didn't stop anti-submarine warfare, what happens to the viability of your submarines over time? And that gets to a second problem, which is, can you be sure, if you go to freezing everything, that everything really is frozen? And then finally, there's a question of negotiability. Once you start looking at these problems, what looks initially like a very simple idea turns out to require negotiations on both sides, and those negotiations may be much more complex than they first look.
Professor Nye, perhaps we can close with a brief comment by you concerning the ethical or moral considerations of what we've been talking about. To what extent should we think about this nuclear arms competition in moral and ethical terms?
Well, I think one has to. I mean, killing hundreds of millions of people has to be an ethically immoral act. But I would argue that the net effect of nuclear weapons thus far has been to avoid that. We have not only not seen people killed by nuclear weapons since 1945, but we haven't seen any World War III, which could easily have killed very large numbers of people. Essentially, we're stuck in a world with nuclear weapons. They can't be disinvented or uninvented because the knowledge still will exist. Deterrence is moral, but it's moral only if we work over the long run to get out of that situation. In other words, to take steps toward arms control, to take steps toward reducing those political tensions which have driven the situation.
Professor Nye, thank you for being with us today to discuss this most important of policy problems. This is Michael Nacht for International Portfolio.
Now for another view, here's Andrew Pierre of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. He raises critical issues about the likelihood of nuclear war.
Our guest today is the renowned Dr. Herman Kahn, world theorist on problems of nuclear war, eminent futurologist, the founder and now chairman of the board of the Hudson Institute outside of New York City. Dr. Kahn, over 20 years ago, you wrote the classic bestseller, On Thermonuclear War. Since then, a great deal has changed. Technology has advanced, world politics has evolved, arms control has had its ups and downs. A lot of people are concerned that nuclear war today seems more likely than ever. Do you agree with that?
We have argued in the past that we were just lucky that we didn't have a nuclear war in the 50s and the 60s. The forces were accident-prone. We didn't understand much about how they should operate. They were vulnerable. They really were badly designed. This is not true today. On both sides, the forces have an intrinsic stability, and as far as we know, are not accident-prone, and are not particularly prone to preemption. Also, both sides are very cautious, and under these circumstances, it's difficult to write a scenario for nuclear war.
Many people today who have not been thinking professionally about nuclear war as you have for so many years are scared. They really believe that there's now a 50% chance of a nuclear war, whereas you and many other strategists, and myself, in fact, think that's much too high a percentage. How do you explain this discrepancy between public opinion and professional opinion?
First and foremost, there's a kind of classic situation which Toynbee once mentioned of retreat forcing a return. And the return is always dangerous. For 17 years, we had this constant military budget. For 17 years, the Soviets increased their total doubled, more than doubled. Now you want to do something about it. Coming back to do something about the 17 years of neglect, the 17 years of apathy, the 17 years of complacency, is always dangerous. And it is perceived as much more dangerous by the general public than it is. Second point I would make. When the Reagan administration came in, they looked to many people as the most insouciant about nuclear war. And they made remarks, which I think are absolutely correct. A limited war may stay limited. Victory in war is possible. Now, these remarks are taken as either insane or immoral or both by many people in the general public. When you make an insouciant remark about nuclear war today, even if it's correct, you better have a half-hour sober speech explaining what you mean. And that's what they fail to do.
Now, offensive forces are becoming more accurate, and some people fear a first-strike capacity on both sides. Do you consider this to be destabilizing?
Only moderately so. In non-thermonuclear war, I introduced the concept of multi-stability, and it's one of the few concepts in the book which simply got no play at all. I argue that what you want is stability against first strike and stability against provocation, and that there was a gross exaggeration of the destabilizing character of forces which had some first strike capability. Both Washington and Moscow are desperately afraid of war. Neither has any desire to go ahead. Both would prefer getting a first strike to getting in a second strike, but both greatly prefer no war at all to getting in a first strike. But it's kind of important that neither side feel totally safe that they can do anything provocative.
If Washington and Moscow, as you say, are desperately afraid of nuclear war, why has there been so little progress over the past decades in achieving arms control?
Well, there's actually been much more arms control than I expected. Recently, some colleagues of mine reread On Thermonuclear War and pointed out I made only two serious mistakes. Both were exaggerations of the arms race. The point is that the real arms control has been implicit. When that book was written, the Soviets were spending about 15 to 20% of their gross national product on military products. We were spending like 8, 9. In both cases, it went down enormously. Soviets now are widely supposed to spend like 12 to 14%. We have been spending 5 and reaching up to 7. That decrease in the level of GNP spent on arms represents an extraordinary first for arms control. Much more important, though, is the lack of nuclear proliferation. In the 50s and 60s, when we talked about these problems, we assumed that they were basically technological, and that while there were many political constraints against proliferation, these would be overwhelmed. In fact, they have not been overwhelmed. You have at most 6 or 7 nuclear powers, and counting Israel and India in them. You have maybe 10 powers who are sort of thinking about getting nuclear weapons. And I don't know of anybody who I would have had great respect for in 1950 and 1960 who would have predicted that result for the mid and early 1980s.
But which would you give higher priority to, preventing the spread or retarding the spread of nuclear weapons, or achieving arms control over the two basic nuclear arsenals?
Well, arms control is such a big worry that everything depends on what kind of arms control. I don't think of either SALT I or SALT II as being spectacularly useful agreements. SALT I was part of a pattern of détente, you know, and to the extent that you like détente, that was an essential agreement. It is not to say that SALT I and SALT II are useless. It's to say that they have both defects and positives.
But do you believe that the current administration is pursuing the START negotiations and the INF negotiations in a better manner, let's say, than previous U.S. administrations? More likely to achieve meaningful arms control?
They have a tougher job, in a way. Let me review a little bit what happened. In the 60s, many Americans thought the Soviets wanted arms control badly and wanted a kind of parity. Actually, the Soviets never expected to get parity, near as I can tell. They assumed that they would have to be inferior to the United States because we were bigger and more technological and richer. To their surprise, they were allowed to pass us. And to the great surprise of many of my friends and colleagues, they continued to go ahead. In other words, if you look at Soviet military budgets, say, from 63 to 80, or right through today, roughly, they tend to increase like 4 to 5% a year, which is roughly the same rate at which their gross national product grew. Our budget was essentially constant for that entire 17-year period, except for the operational expenses of the Vietnamese War. Now, in 17 years, 4 to 5% growth rate just about doubles or more. President Carter was forced by the calculations and studies his own administration did to put a stop to that process in 1980. And he didn't want to do that. He didn't want to be known as the president who started a new arms race. But the numbers simply forced him.
But it is a fact that President Carter achieved a SALT II agreement, which, although not ratified, was believed by many to be providing a kind of ceiling, if you like, on the arms race. Some people believe that this administration is not putting forth positions which are likely to lead to results in terms of negotiated arms control.
I would argue you're incorrect in two separate concepts. Number one, going from a position where we had major superiority in the 60s to a position where I would argue we have major, though not as major, inferiority today, is not a success. Just not a success. And everything that was part of that policy, including the détente policy, which said, don't worry about it, it's not important, don't care about it. And I have so many of my friends who were actually approved of that policy who still kept asking themselves, why did the Soviets keep going? Why do they keep going? They keep going because they understand something which we don't, that to have greater strength, superiority, is important. Now, it is true that it's less and less important every year that it continues. In other words, the kind of overkill position gets more credible today than it was in 1960 when I wrote my book.
The Reagan administration came into office at the beginning of this decade seemingly not too enthusiastic about arms control as a process. It may be in the course of changing its views now. What do you really consider to be the prospects for a serious arms control during the decade?
I would argue that the Reagan administration has a rather good chance of getting arms control in just the terms they put it. Until we get strong and give the Russians a reason for it, they're not going to give us any deals we're interested in. They've come to the Green Party because they fear us. Now, I'll make the second point. This is the crucial issue. The Russians are in a position where they're economically incredibly tight. They're not in a state of collapse, and they're not going to collapse. But, boy, they don't want to pull in their belt anymore for arms. You know that, and I know that, and they know that. If you give them a reasonable deal, they're likely to pick up the deal. But if you give them a free ride, if you tell them, look at these peace groups in the United States, look at these peace groups in Germany, you don't have to give away anything. You can get it for nothing. Under those circumstances, it's very hard for the Russians to make sacrifices.
But if we and the Soviets and the West and the East remain in political competition, ideological competition over the decade, as certainly appears likely, can we really expect a serious arms control agreement which is de-linked, if you like, from the political competition?
Clearly, it's a lot easier to have an arms control agreement if you're not pushing each other around. Nevertheless, at least in principle and in practice, we have seen enemies who fight each other to death still fight according to rules. This is not uncommon in world history. But you can't do it if they think there's a free ride. And it's very important to understand that.
Let's then talk about the no first use strategy. We are all aware of the article in Foreign Affairs published half a year or so ago by four former officials in various administrations. Very few people know that you, in fact, were talking about the desirability of a no first use strategy 16, 17 years ago.
When I first recommended no first use some almost 20 years ago, actually, my comment was that this is not good for the United States or NATO, but it's good for the world. And we have enough to spare. We don't have to be niggly. In other words, you cannot live in a world in which people treat nuclear weapons as just another weapon. You've got to have a taboo against them. The only purpose of nuclear weapons should be to deter, balance, or correct for the use of nuclear weapons by others. Today, I would argue no first use of the proper sort would be good for the United States, too, and for the world, both. Mainly because we have to take the political and moral high ground. But my concept of no first use is as a part of a rearmament program.
Well, I think that's one point, perhaps the central point, where your argument differs from the argument made more recently, because you have always said that it was absolutely essential to have a credible conventional posture at the same time and a high defense capacity, as you've just said. And I think it is fair to say that the European peace movement, which is now sort of seized upon the no first issue as one of the arguments in their quiver, are people who themselves would not advocate spending a great deal more money on conventional defense or in raising the manpower levels necessary for conventional defense. But let's assume for the moment that you're in Bonn and you're the Chancellor of Germany and you're interested in avoiding any war, of course, but in particular a nuclear war. Nevertheless, you feel that the best deterrent is the perception on the part of the Soviets that any attack will escalate rapidly to a nuclear war. How would you then feel about a no-first-use declaration?
Well, first and foremost, I ask the following question. Assume there really was a conventional attack on West Germany. Would you authorize use of nuclear weapons? The answer is always no. Would the English authorize nuclear weapons? No. Would the French authorize it? No. Do you think the Russians know this? Yes, they know this. Then in what sense is this an important threat? I would argue as follows, basically. If you want to get away in the cheap in your defense, you can try it, and it will probably succeed. But if it doesn't, you will be to blame for the worst disaster in history, probably, or one of the worst disasters in history. Now, the Germans want to get away in the cheap. The French want to get away in the cheap. The British, a little less so, but also in the cheap. All right, I know of no policy which gets away in the cheap.
Isn't this really a bit of a false debate? Because the NATO strategy, MC-62, has never called for early recourse to nuclear weapons. It's always called for a graduated, flexible response.
I think that's partly correct. If you read the Russian writings, you read the Western writings, both sides agree that neither side is likely to go to war except out of desperation. And that's new in the world. In other words, nobody goes to war to achieve world domination. Nobody goes to war to double his territories, at least not the Russians or Americans.
If that's the case, given the fact that we now have roughly 7,000 tactical nuclear weapons in Europe and just outside of Europe, and we're planning to deploy a whole new family of ground-launched cruise missiles and Pershing 2s, is it not possible to radically reduce our nuclear forces in Europe, especially some of the older ones, perhaps in an agreement with the Soviets whereby they would reduce their SS-4s and SS-5s?
I go back to my original comment. If all you're worried about is deliberate war, as you had, say, in World War I, as you had in World War II, as you had in much of history, yes, you can cut it by large amounts. There are many other requirements for nuclear forces than deterring a deliberate, conscious war for gain. When one looks at these requirements, one notices that one needs very capable forces.
Let's talk about another system which we were getting to a bit before, and that's the MX. I assume you believe it is important to deploy the MX for political reasons as well as strategic reasons in order to maintain high-level deterrence. Well, I should ask, do you believe that? And if so, what would you advise the president to choose as a mode for deployment?
If I deploy the MX, it's partly for political reasons and partly because I think they're useful. Let me be very clear. I think there's a window of vulnerability. I think it's a window of danger. I don't think the Soviets look upon it as a window of opportunity, except politically. I will sleep comfortably at night if we don't fix up this window of vulnerability, because I believe the Soviets are prudent and cautious, and therefore I'll sleep comfortable. Mm-hmm. And the other, if I was President of the United States, I simply would not rely on Soviet prudence and caution to that extent. Well, I think it's irresponsible to do so.
That's very clear. We've been talking with Dr. Herman Kahn, futurologist, nuclear theorist. This is Andrew Pierre for International Portfolio.
This concludes Side 1 of International Portfolio. Coming up on Side 2, a look at Soviet and Chinese policies under the new Moscow and Peking leadership.